I'm Alec Baldwin, and this is Here's the Thing from WNYC Radio. My chance to talk with artists, policymakers, and performers, to hear their stories, what inspired their creations, what decisions changed their careers, what relationships influenced their work.
When an actor acknowledges the audience, then you can have a moment of ecstasy.
For me, writing plays has always been very tricky. I don't know a lot. I don't have a lot to say.
I mean, he said there's only two directions, Days. A little more or a little less. That was it.
Getting started in theater is difficult. Maintaining a career even harder. Becoming a true success is nearly impossible. Each of my guests today have accomplished that feat. All three have contributed work that has profoundly affected audiences and changed the landscape of American theater. I'll speak to a playwright and a veteran actor of stage and screen, but first, a powerful performer who's most at home on the Broadway stage, often in musicals. Last year, she appeared on Broadway in David Mamet's The Anarchist, but she's capable of anything.
You'll be swell. You'll be great. Gonna have the whole world on a plate. Starting here, starting now. Honey, everything's coming. Roseanne.
Patti LuPone was in the very first class of the drama division at Juilliard. She has 26 Broadway credits to date and has won 2 Tony Awards, one for Evita and one for Gypsy. She's worked in film and on television, most notably as the mom on the ABC drama Life Goes On.
So how was your day, Libby? Oh, just fine, thank you for asking. More fun and excitement than I knew what to do with. And yours? I didn't do the ironing. You what?
LuPone's career has not been without its heartbreaks. In 1976, she was hired to replace the lead in the musical The Baker's Wife.
Who does he think he is? Who could be as handsome? Who could be as smart as he thinks he is?
She was on the road for a grueling 6 months. They rehearsed every day and performed every night. The reviews were so terrible, ushers sent candy backstage to cheer the actors up.
I've always said there's a fine line between a hit and a flop, and it's, you don't know what it is. You don't know why it is a hit, and you don't know why it is a flop. You know, if it's really terrible, you know right off the bat, and you're not going to take the job. But if it has the potential to be a hit and ends up being a flop, you can't figure it out.
So you do this show, and when you come out of that, like, what's the lesson for you? Was there something you said to yourself, never again am I going to...
No, I went into a depression for 9 months. I was on Valium to sleep for the 6 months, and I went into a Valium depression for 9 months, gained 40 pounds, woke up, went, what the hell just happened? And I couldn't say—
Why do you think that is? Like you care a lot. There's nothing casual about you. There's nothing amateurish about you. You know, you're very serious, and you're very dedicated. You're very hardworking, along with being very talented. And you feel these wounds. Why do you think that is? Why did it affect you so much?
Well, our business is subjective. It's all subjective. You know what I mean? You talk to anybody from The Baker's Wife, and they can remember it as if it was yesterday. And there's blood spilled, and we became a blood family. I just saw Timmy Jerome, who's in Phantom now, and we see each other, and what we recall is that bonding and that horrible experience, and we can talk about it as if it was yesterday. I think it's because, you know, it happened to us. Of course, it happened to the creators, but they're not on stage. We're on stage succeeding or failing in front of an audience. We're on stage being judged by the audience. We're the messengers.
We're the ones who take the hit.
We take the hit all the time.
We're the ones who take the hit.
And this was really abusive. It was just horrible. I woke up one morning and my face was filled with what looked like whiteheads. The entire face had raised bumps on it. I didn't know what it was. I went to sleep, woke up, and the entire face, maybe it was from the Valium. I have no idea, but I was, right. Things were happening to us, physically happening to us.
And when does the sun come out for you? When does the sun come out for Patti LuPone career-wise?
I think when I go back to work with David Mamet. I go back and work with David. I go into...
What do you mean, go back?
David and I did a play in Chicago. Was that after Baker's Wife? Was that... I see. I'm trying to keep it straight.
What play did you do with him first?
The very first play I did with him was a thing called All Men Are Whores. Kevin Klein, Sam Chichifis, and I did it at Yale Rep for one night. I said, "Hey, Dave, we opened it closed in New Haven," and New Haven used to be one of the circuit. When you took a show out of town, your first stop was New Haven. And it was a big deciding factor. Sure. So we opened and closed.
We bombed in New Haven.
We bombed in it. Well, and from there he gave me a play called The Woods.
And what happens when you do The Woods?
Well, I go back to what I was trained for. And I go back to an honest environment, pretty much.
And you're back to the circle of trust.
Yeah.
Everything feels right.
Yeah.
This is more like it.
And it's a risk. It's a big risk. I mean, every time I work with David, I learn so much as a human being.
What year was that approximately?
I think late 1976, 77.
So you had a relationship with him.
Yes. Well, we met him.
For 35 years.
Yes, yes. And I will drop everything to do a play by David. Everything. I don't care how risky it is. I learn so much from David, and I instinctually have the mammoth speak. That's something that I know how to do, his rhythms. And I think it's because, as someone said, I cut my teeth on David.
Is Evita the next big thing for you?
I'm trying to think. I did
my
stage
recollection, Evita is the big thing. Evita is the thing that changes your life.
That was 1979. Okay. But in between—
And how does that happen?
I auditioned. Joanna Merlin is Hal Prince's casting director, and of course—
Hal directed.
And so I was brought in for a preliminary audition, and then I was told to make myself free, make sure that I made myself free for the final callback. And as I understand it, Hal wanted to cast actors in the roles, as opposed to just musical theater people. So I think that's one of the reasons why I got in there, because they knew I was an actor. In between, there were several plays. There was stage directions by Israel Horovitz, John Glover, Ellen Green, and I down at the Public, while Meryl's doing...
You're doing everything you can to scratch that itch of yours and not become a star. No, I get it.
It was the available work.
We're about to talk about the moment when perhaps one of the greatest musical stars of the last 50 years is born on Broadway.
Thank you.
So let's talk about how the moment this happens. Hal Prince wants people who can act and sing, and you go to make yourself available to the final callback, and what happened? How do you feel when you're in that room?
Well, I was very mad because I was actually shooting 1941, and there was a little issue about letting me go. And the producer said, if you're not back tomorrow or the next day, you'll never work in Hollywood again. So I left Hollywood with those words ringing in my ear, and I woke up in New York to the 1978 blizzard where there were like 2 feet of snow on the ground.
Couldn't get back to L.A.?
I couldn't get back to L.A.
Did they fire you?
No. Christopher Reeve got me on the plane. I only missed 3 hours of shooting. When they said, how'd you get here? I said, Superman. I did. It's absolutely
that Juilliard camaraderie.
Exactly. So I went to the final callback, but I was really mad because I didn't want to do this musical. I didn't like the music. I thought—
Which one?
Evita.
You didn't like it?
Uh-uh. No.
What specifically? You're a smart woman. What specifically didn't you like?
Well, I didn't like... I heard the White Album, the Julie Covington, David Essex, Colm Wilkinson. Very rocky, weird music. But it rocked out a lot. And I thought, what's the matter with me? I'm a rocker. I want to be a rocker.
Right.
It was
Here's your chance.
Really, really high. Didn't grab me. I mean, I grew up on Rodgers and Hammerstein. I grew up on Julie Stein, Meredith Wilson, Stephen Sondheim. This was not a musical to me. This was noise from Britain. You know what I mean?
So how did you go out there and do it?
I went out, and the final audition, I was wet from my knees down. I was wearing sneakers and jeans, not knowing it was going to snow. So stupid, I didn't look at the weather report.
Yeah.
I went out there, and I blasted, literally blasted through Rainbow High, Buenos Aires, and Don't Cry For Me, Argentina. And there were tears in my eyes, apparently. And there were tears of rage, certainly
right.
Not tears of...
Right.
And I left, and I got a call on the set. I made it back, and I got a call on the set in the makeup trailer. And they said, you've got the part. And I started to cry again because I had promised David that I would reprise The Woods at the Public Theater with Ulu Grossbart directing.
What I love is that you're going to blow your Hollywood film career to go do a musical you don't even like. And then that one they offer to you, you're not sure you're going to take that because you got to go do another little mammoth play.
Well, I had been trained to be an actor, and I thought my responsibility was to act at every possible opportunity, and especially good opportunities.
Keep working. If it's worthy material.
Ply your craft. And if it's good material. David and I forged a friendship and a bond, and I didn't want to let him down. David and I became really, really good friends. David lived on 20th. He'd come over all the time for breakfast. We'd walk around. We'd go do antiquing.
I'm going to start calling you Al, by the way, because you keep changing the subject. What happened with Hal? Get you to do that material? And it became what it became.
Well, no, I knew I had to do it. I cried because I knew that I couldn't do The Woods, and I had to do Evita because I knew I wanted to work with Hal, and I knew that it would change the course of my career.
You knew going in that it was going to be a hit.
There was so much hype before.
Have they done it in London?
Yeah.
So it was a big hit in London.
Huge hit in London.
And you were in the American cast. It was a huge hit in London. So you knew this was a big opportunity.
And
for
there
you.
Was hype. You can't believe. That was my first indication that this was going to be a tough experience because how am I going to get around the hype? It was the first musical that I was aware of that had so much pre-opening hype.
The modern way.
Not even buzz. And it was frightening. And I had no vocal technique.
So now this thing is all hyped up. You've been through everything you've been through. You've had some good times and some tough times, and you've worked hard. God knows, 4 years on the road with Houseman in that company. And you step out for the Broadway opening, the opening of Evita. What was that like for you? How did that evening go?
I had the flu.
Perfect. Of course you did.
Yeah.
It won't be easy. You'll think it's strange when I try to explain how I feel. But I still need your love after all that I've done.
And I threw up in the sink before I sang Don't Cry for Me, Argentina. I'm sure it was a combination of... I got extremely bad notices opening in L.A. and extremely bad notices opening in San Francisco. And Hal came to me and said, "We're going to laugh about this in 20 years, Patty." They pulled the entire company together. And he said there was an article coming out in Susie Knickerbocker's column the next day that I was going to be fired and that Actors Equity was waiting to clear Elaine Page to take my place. And this was in the newspaper.
She's a Brit.
Yeah, she's the one that originated in London. I'm dealing with all of this press of me being fired and me not being able to sing the part and still going on for my
throwing up in the sink.
Well, that was opening night.
Right. And so you go out and do the opening and what happens?
Bad reviews again. Actually, they weren't bad. They dismissed Hal. And this was an innovative concept, an innovative production. They dismissed Hal, and they barely touched on Mandy and me. And that's worse when you're ignored.
Right.
It's one thing if they're passionate and you're bad,
right,
and passionate when you're good, but when you're ignored. And Mandy and I, at one point, I think I said, "You want to go out for a drink?" He said, "Yeah." And we were on 52nd. I think that's where the Broadway Theater is, and we walked down 8th Avenue, and simultaneously, we burst into tears. I mean, we worked hard in those parts, and then to be ignored is tough. And then, of course, 9 months later, they give us the Tonys.
When you win the Tony, was it any vindication for you at all, or was it just an
empty? Oh, of course.
It was.
Oh,
so you
my
felt
God.
Good. When you won,
oh,
how did you feel?
Oh, yeah, it's such a relief. It was such a relief because, really, have you
did
read
it wipe
my...
everything away?
No, because I was still performing and still scared out of my mind every night. I envied Mandy because Mandy was just all over the place. He didn't have a problem singing it, so he told me something the other day. We were talking about Evita, and he said, "Well, Hal told me to go. He wanted me over there." And I said to Hal, "How do I get there?" He said, "I don't know. Just get there." And so that's where he does a jeté across the stage. And I would see it every night going, "Why is Mandy doing that?" And it was because Hal told him to get there. And Mandy put
how.
It in. He didn't care how, so Mandy put it in. And it became part of his performance.
Sure.
And so... And I suppose in that respect, Hal gives the actor freedom, but I didn't have that freedom because I was so tied up in a knot because I didn't think I could sing it.
I wanna be a part of Villa Buenos Aires, Big Apple. Would I have done what I did if I hadn't thought, if I hadn't known we would stay together?
Really, and you know, when you in a rehearsal period, you know this, you have to do it over and over and over again. So you're not hitting that D in Screw the Middle Classes once. You're not hitting that G in Screw the Middle Classes once. You're doing it over and over again. I didn't have vocal technique to know that I didn't have to hit those notes every day. I didn't have vocal technique. I got it during the run by from a kid in the chorus.
Who?
David Vosburgh. I came off stage in
LA. He gave you tips.
They got him a piano. They put a piano in my dressing room, and he worked with me an hour every single day before the show. He would come to me and work out of the goodness of his heart.
David Vosburgh. Where is he now?
He's in Ohio. He's a director of opera. But he would give me a vocal technique. He would warm me up. And the difficult thing was to apply what he had just taught me that night, because I would do one thing right, something else would go disastrously wrong. But at least I was getting a technique to sing that part. He saved my job. And they knew that, and they paid him.
Now, you say, when you talk about this, you talk about the tension and the anxiety and the fear, and you don't really want to necessarily be doing Evita because you got another David play and this and this and that. When did it start to become fun for you?
Oh, Anything Goes was a ball.
Okay, so talk about that. Why?
Oh, because of the material and because of the cast, and it was hysterical.
Who directed you?
Jerry Zaks. And Jerry did a great job of directing.
And he's tough.
Yes, he is. Yeah. However, these were the way musicals used to be written. You'd have a joke coming and then a gorgeous song. The material was so ripe and so beautiful. If I was in a bad mood, all I had to do was hear that. And okay, I know where I am tonight.
Exactly.
Just looking at the audience and seeing tears of joy from laughter. The only thing we are as actors are messengers. That's all we are, correct? We are delivering the playwright's intention through the concept of the director. And I come on stage, if I feel confident in the role, then I give it away. I give it away anyway, but it's all about them. So I have to go out there and love them. And I do. And I think they see that. They can relax with me because they know I'm giving it to them. I'm not, you know, there are some actors that don't want to be on stage.
Well, it's funny
and
you say
that. Well,
because you just nailed it. Because Patti LuPone to me is a woman who comes out there, but the first thing she stops her and she's like, you know, how's everybody doing? It was like a little moment, like a nightclub singer, like, you know, how you all doing tonight? Without saying how you all doing tonight. Like, just connect to them and let them feel like if there's no place else we'd rather be, is there, than here right now.
Well, I think our responsibility is to relax them. You've been in an audience, I've been in an audience, where we're worried for the performer. And then we're not having the experience. They're paying a lot.
And if I'm worried for the performer, and they should be worried for, then I'm worried for me because I want to get the F out of there. Yeah.
Hello. Our responsibility is the minute we hit the deck is to relax the audience, and that is what is called command.
But the tiger's come at night with their voices soft as thunder.
I think that you can see when people care and when audiences can see when they don't care.
Because you seem like someone in the years I've bumped into you, run into you, known you better. You seem to care the exact same amount as you used to.
I love what I do. And I love the audience, and I love the fact that I get to do it. And I love our craft very, very much. And it's a noble craft. We have a responsibility to it and to the audience and to the playwright and to the message. I won't ever care less.
He took my childhood in his stride, but he was gone when autumn came.
You can see Patti LuPone next in the third season of American Horror Story Coven on FX. In a minute, I'll talk with Tony-nominated playwright John Robin Bates, who said about Patti, there's an instrument in her. She's the kind of actor that makes me feel compelled to write.
There are dreams that cannot be.
I'm Alec Baldwin, and here's the thing. Take a listen to our archive. More in-depth and honest conversations with artists, policymakers, and performers.
I never was comfortable in front of a camera.
Really?
I never felt I was photogenic. I was never happy with how I looked. I became a musician because it's about a microphone, not about a camera.
Hear about Billy Joel's insecurities and David Letterman's ambitions.
I really thought I could write half hours, situation comedies.
At hearsthething.org.
Here's the Thing is produced by WNYC Radio and distributed by PRX.org, the Public Radio Exchange. I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing from WNYC Radio.
Whatever it is, whatever you do, you're our daughter, and I will love you.
John Robin Bates's Broadway play Other Desert Cities was nominated for a Tony this year. The play is about family dysfunction and the choices we make.
There are consequences to our actions.
What does that mean?
How could I trust you? How could I ever be in your presence, my dear?
Joe Mantello directed Other Desert Cities. He and Bates were a couple in the 1990s. In the theater world, it's hard to find someone who wouldn't want to work with Robbie. He's complicated and kind. During our conversation, John Robin Bates confessed there's been a dark side to his success on Broadway.
I'm ruined for off-Broadway. Now, I sort of say things like, well, that play's an off-Broadway play. It's not a Broadway play. Making fun of myself. You know, you're in this great, great, grand old house, you know, that's built for a kind of big experience, and the drama is somehow expanded.
Bates is also wary of going back to Hollywood. In 2006, he left ABC's Brothers and Sisters, a show he created and executive produced after the first season. Working in L.A. was not for him.
The guy who really ran the entertainment division kept saying, I don't understand why anybody watches this show.
But how soon
he would call me and scream at me. I actually said to him, I don't know who you think you're talking to. Yeah. And I would, you know, politely hang up and say, I'm leaving the conversation now.
It took a while for Robbie Bates to recover. But one day, now back on the East Coast, he got the idea for Other Desert Cities.
I had forgotten how to write. This is the thing I think about with Other Desert Cities, is it's the play where I taught myself how to write again. I was sitting at a beach with my notebook, and I'm thinking about how to get back into it and what matters to me. And I just sort of self-destructed at Brothers and Sisters. I found myself very much like the character in my play, a writer who is a dangerous creature. And I had a note to myself, play about daughter of a famous family who writes a book about her growing up in this family, something like that, the danger of telling the truth that turns out to be a lie. And at that moment, this lady of a certain age walked by me, and she looked to me like Pat Buckley, the old doyen of New York conservative politics, the wife of
Bill Buckley.
And I'd had lunch with her once and found her to be charming and engaged, and this woman walked by me on this beach with her hat and in a one-piece bathing suit. I immediately felt the mother in that play, and I suddenly remembered old California the way it was when I was a kid. And we were just in the throes of an election at the time, too, or about to be. And the Republicans of certainly of that period, and even more so today, were very confusing to me because they didn't seem recognizable to me as having a coherent, cohesive, cogent argument for their principled positions, which had to be principled in some way. The play just came together in one fell swoop. Old California, conservatives, yeah. The old Hollywood
Reaganites.
System, Reaganites. I even remembered I'd gone to high school with, I think, the daughter of John Gavin. And I thought, you know, and because I love Touch of Evil, and I think, isn't John Gavin? No, he's not in Touch of Evil. He's in
Psycho.
He's in all these movies, and I thought about—
He was the ambassador to Mexico.
That's right, as is the Stacy Keach character in my play. And I thought about—
Your character's based on John Gavin.
to some extent, there are all these archetypes in
there.
No,
I hear you. I love it.
At the back of all this, of course, there's also Joe Mantello, who, you know, we're no longer a couple, but he's my family, my best friend.
And you ceased being a couple what year?
2002.
So it was a while.
And he kept saying to me, with all possible respect, nobody's waiting for the next Robbie Bates play. And, you know, these are chilling words because I have so much to say and it's not coming out.
My equivalent of that is my agent said to me, he goes, it's not that these people don't want to hire you because they don't like you. He says, they don't want to hire you because they don't think of you at all.
Jesus.
I thought, wow.
Well, it's terrible because the worst thing that can happen to an artist, I'm invisible.
Sure.
I no longer matter. Yeah. For me, writing plays has always been very tricky. I don't know a lot. I don't have a lot to say. I reach things very slowly, and I sometimes it seems facile and easy, and to me sometimes my thoughts and my sort of expressed opinions in plays seem hollow or naive even.
Why?
Because I know there are deeper truths always to be found and that I'm—
But don't you think that seeking them and being aware of that makes you more likely to find it than anybody else? You didn't go to college, did you?
No, I
Why?
Didn't.
You wound up educating yourself.
I wish I had gone to college.
Why didn't you?
I was a depressed and unsettled kid. And
why?
I think I wasn't at peace with probably any element of who I was, whether it was a sort of nascent intellectual or sort of pre-expressive homosexual kid or—
You grew up where?
Variously, L.A.
You were born where?
In L.A.
And you lived there till you were how old?
7, then Brazil for 3 years in Rio, and then South Africa for 6.5 years till I was 18.
And your father was in the condensed milk business.
My father worked for a giant multinational, Carnation Milk, yeah. Right. It was a condensed milk business.
So L.A., Brazil, South Africa.
And then back to L.A.
Back to L.A. And when you finally get back to L.A., how old are you?
18.
So high school's over.
I just finished high school. I'd sort of lost time through all the travel.
What was high school in South Africa like?
I couldn't get used to things like cricket and corporal punishment. You know, you'd get caned for, like, not doing well on a spelling test. Literally caned. And I think I was so busy trying to be sly and charming that I forgot how to be me. That, I think, led me to rebel against learning itself. So I was sort of interested in the few things I was interested in, literature, history, but I wouldn't apply myself to anything except escape. And part of escape meant not going to college. I was really lonely, and I kind of became a depressed kid. And
how did that manifest itself, if you can say?
I think I—
Did you know you were gay then?
Yes, I definitely knew that. I knew.
Did that add to your depression? Did it make you feel more isolated
totally.
In the environment you lived in? Because it wasn't proactive, the gay community there.
In 1973? Yeah, well, I think my parents, who loved me very much, were distracted by their own terrors. There are certain families that are born in terror and live in terror.
Conceived in terror. I need you to write a play for me. I want to be called Conceived in Terror. Here we go ahead.
Well, no. I mean, Death of a Salesman is a family that lives in terror.
You were how old when you arrived in Durban?
10.
So you were there 8 years.
Yeah, I was there almost 8 years.
A critical time. 10 years old. So all of your real back half of your childhood, your teenage years especially, you are in Durban.
I guess I was 17 or something when we left.
But you had finished the high school program.
No, I finished it in L.A.
You did? Where?
Yeah, Beverly Hills High
now,
School.
Now, what was that like?
I, you know, was the only kid I knew who rode their bike to school because everybody else's parents had given them a Fiat.
Literally?
Yeah, or something.
Who were your friends then? Who did you become friends with? Anyone?
Oh, yeah. In fact, Jenny Livingston went on to make Paris is Burning. Great documentary. Tina Landau, a great theater director. Gina Gershon, my oldest friend from high school. We were in plays together in the drama department. So I became friends with and I say this with real respect and love, with fellow freaks.
How were you feeling about yourself and about life that last year in Beverly Hills?
I think I was scared to death still. I mean, it was just a new form of foreignness, but it had the pattern of something very familiar to me. But, you know, I remember being taken to a party really early on, and I had developed a kind of weird eye beforehand for art. I thought maybe I was going to be a painter or an art historian or something. And I walk into this house, and there is a giant David Hockney, and next to it is a giant Motherwell. I'm standing in front of this giant painting that's famous that I've looked at in books, Thames and Hudson art books, while I was in Durban at the art library of the university. I don't know, the world was just very real and different, and it was easier to, like, have sex, and it was easier to function.
Were you writing?
I guess I was sort of writing, yeah.
What were you writing?
I was writing really bad short stories about alienated Paul Bowles kids adrift in foreign countries, which is basically, to tell you the truth, still what I'm doing. It just looks slightly, the wallpaper's prettier now.
Where were you living at that age?
I was living on friends' sofas, like the parents of children I went to high school with.
You were the beloved house guest.
I was. I was just this freak, you know, and I was at odds with my family at the time, you know, and I had escaped, and it was just a nightmare.
How do we get from there to Fair Country, Gordon Davidson?
You know, in Pinocchio, where he falls in with actors?
Mm-hmm.
I'm walking around. I ran into this girl I knew from high school. She said, "What are you doing?" And I'm sort of looking for a job. I think I'm starving to death. I'm not sure. She said to me, and I should have known, she said, "Well, my father just fired me. He needs a new assistant." He needs a new assistant. And I was like, "Well, what does he do?" And she said, "Oh, he's a film producer."
Who was the film producer?
It's this great guy. And he... my first day at the office, he says to me, "Whatever you do, answer the phones, but never pick up the phone." And I was like, "I don't even know what that means." And he said, "You'll do fine." And he had a gang of cronies, all of whom had contempt for the studio system, had done well, fallen out of favor, usually had destroyed themselves through my favorite thing, their own ambivalence. I found myself at home for the first time in my life.
in the nest of scorpions.
Yes.
You did.
I did. I found myself. I said, "This I know." Yeah, because nobody is trying to pass.
Yeah.
It's a den of thieves, yeah, quite literally.
We're hitting the ball
here. It was still the days of speakerphone. And they would have fights. They had a tower on Sunset Boulevard. They had a nest of rooms in a tower. And they would be fighting with each other. And then there would suddenly be a pause. Someone would say, "Geez, if you could see what I see right now, that girl walking down Sunset, she is so beautiful." The fight was over.
Yeah, yeah.
Nothing meant anything.
The narcotic of sex.
That's right. One of them asked for a glass of water. This is my first few weeks there. 1982, what do I know? You would go to the sink, bring a glass of water, spit it out, like practically on me, and say, "This isn't water." And I would say, "Yes, it's water. What are you talking about? That's water." They'd say, "I want professional water."
Yeah.
And the whole time became about professional water.
How long did that last?
2, 3, 4, 5. Like four some years.
No.
No, but it got...
You were in the scorpion's nest looking down at the women's asses for 4 years?
And I would copy everything down.
Right.
And so at the same time I started hanging around with these actors, there was a sort of... an equally desperate contingent of avant-gardist, odd playwrights living on the fringes of everything. And so I lived between these two worlds, one of which was sort of drunk and druggy, and the other was insane,
megalomaniacal.
Thank you.
That's what I'm here for.
Maniacal.
You just think of the words and I'll say them.
Thank you.
We're going to beam each other.
I know, it's like Bluetooth without the technology.
Bluetooth me. Go ahead.
I had to come up with a play for one of these sort of workshop things that we would put together. And one of these playwrights said to me, so what's your play? And me, bullshitting, I said, yeah, it's called Meslansky Zelinsky. On the spot, I just came up with the name.
Based on those guys?
Yeah. I said, yeah, it's called Meslansky Zelinsky.
You just based it on the guys in the tower?
I said, it's just them talking. And I put all my notes together, and we did it. And
that was the first one you wrote?
Yeah.
Almost 30 years later, Bates continues to draw inspiration from all types of sources. With Other Desert Cities, Bates wrote the part of the family's patriarch with one of his favorite performers in mind, Stacy Keach. I worship Stacy. I mean, I worship Stacy.
He is...
One of the great wild mustangs of all theater history.
He's great, and I love him so much. You know, he and Joe didn't know each other, and so they got on the phone before rehearsal. And Stacy says to Joe, you know, I've worked with Robbie before. We've worked together before, and I know him well. And do you know him? Have you worked with him? And how well do you know him? And Joe says, I kind of know him. We lived together for 12 years. But that's Stacy.
Kind of know.
He's like, oh, damn. The great thing about Stacy is he brings centuries of actor's honor onto that stage with him. The honor of honoring fellow actors, the honor of listening, the privilege of being an actor, the privilege of being in the theater, not missing a single show in his 70s, the rituals of it. The privilege of working in the theater is the thing that has been, of everything that's happened to me, just the great honor of being in the American theater in some capacity is what I'm left with. That it's a privilege to be in it. I'm lucky to have found my way back to it.
This is Alec Baldwin. Coming up, I speak with the man who inspired John Robin Bates, Stacy Keach, an artist who has influenced a generation of actors.
The madness liberated me in a way. It liberated me.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I'm Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing from WNYC Radio.
Mark me.
I will.
My hour has almost come. When I, to sulfurous and tormenting flames, must render up myself.
Stacy Keach has played such roles as Richard III, King Lear, Hamlet, as well as Hamlet's ghost, Falstaff, and Willie Loman. He's also played the president of Duff Beer in The Simpsons and Sergeant Stadenko in Cheech and Chong's Up in Smoke.
The only way to catch a doper is when you yourself become a smoker.
Keach is undoubtedly the only actor in Up in Smoke who has also worked with director John Huston. Keach starred in Huston's film Fat City. But perhaps Keach is best known as the irresistible fedora-wearing detective Mike Hammer.
Are you for hire?
No, not at the moment.
My money's too dirty?
I've already got a client.
A lesser performer might have found himself with limited offers after what was Keach's longest-running job. Not so for the 71-year-old actor. His key to career longevity is simple. He says, quote, you need television and movies to make a living, but you'll be taken more seriously if you are stage-worthy. Stage-worthy in Chicago and Washington, but especially New York. And last year, as playwright John Robin Bates mentioned earlier in our show, New York audiences saw him on Broadway in Bates's Other Desert Cities.
Well, we all have our ways of coping, and mine is to be overprotective late in life.
Stacy Keach's dedication to his craft is unwavering, but his technique has changed over the years.
I think in my early days, I started pretty much as, you know, from the outside and tried to get a fix on what the character looked like and then perhaps what he sounded like after that. But it wasn't the best way to start. I mean, I think it's better to start inside and work out if you can. And in later years, I've done that more and more. But I just finished a picture with Alexander Payne called Nebraska, where he called me and he said, I was playing the bad guy in this, and he said, your teeth are too good. So the whole character became centralized in terms of, what I was in here. They made these snarly teeth for me, and it was great, and it sort of gave me a feeling. I would look at myself in the mirror and make, facial expressions, and that sort of gave me the feeling of where this guy was coming from, But it varies. I mean, if you're playing, I was just down in Washington. I'm going to do Falstaff again next year. Mm-hmm. And, he's this big, fat, corpulent guy. And interestingly enough, even with all the physical manifestations of that character, you got to go inside. I mean, that's, And when
it's not enough just to play the look.
No, not at all. Not at all. When I first did it, it was back in 1968, I guess, 45 years ago.
You did what in 68?
Falstaff.
And did they put a suit on you?
Oh, huge, just big.
You were a very lean guy.
I was, and I had to wear this big fat suit. Yeah. Theoni Aldridge designed this leather costume for me. And
what did they do back then in terms of your face when you're lean?
Whiskers.
Oh, I see.
Eyebrows. Right. Had a wig, of course, and a bulbous nose.
What was it about
you? I was way
you?
Too young when I played him.
Well, I was going to say, what was it about you that back then, when you were this athletic, lean, leading man in the movie business, you wanted to put a fat suit on? Why were you running into it? Why were you diving into a fat suit?
Well, because
you wanted great parts.
Exactly. And that is one of I think, of all of Shakespeare's characters, I think it's probably one of the, that and Hamlet are probably the two greatest. Better than Lear, I think. I mean, it's a greater part. There's much more going on with Falstaff, I think.
And you're going to do it again.
Yeah.
So you did Falstaff the first time when?
68. 68 in the park. Oh, yeah, it makes me feel very young.
45 years later.
45 years later.
You're going to play Falstaff.
And I won't have to wear padding this time. No, I'm teasing.
Well, who are you doing it for?
Michael Kahn at the Shakespeare Theater in Washington, D.C.
Oh, you're going to do D.C.
Yeah, we're going to do both parts. We're going to do part one and part two. One of the great experiences of my life was doing those plays together in the park. We started at 10 o'clock at night. We did part one and then part two. And as the dawn came up at the end of the evening, it was the early morning, it was just when Falstaff was being deposed by Prince Hal, played by Sam Waterston.
You grew up where?
I grew up in Southern California.
And your dad was in the business?
Dad was in the business.
What did he do?
He was an actor, director, producer. He did a radio show called Tales of the Texas Rangers with Joel McRae. And that, when I was 12 years old, he used to take me down to NBC Studios, and I would watch these actors do their thing. It was a live radio broadcast with all the Foley and the sound effects and the horses and,
Right.
And that was magic for me. And radio was how I sort of got into it.
And your dad worked in radio?
Yeah.
That was his thing?
That was his thing.
What did he say to you? What was his program with you, so to speak, in terms of your career? Did he want you to do this?
No. He didn't. Absolutely not. He said, no, acting is not something you should do. You want me to be a lawyer. And he wanted my brother to be a doctor. He said, this business is too fraught with insecurity.
Did you almost do that? Did you think about it?
Well, when I started acting in high school, junior high school, was doing plays, and every time I would get a part in a play, my dad would get very excited. He would get very animated, and he wanted to show me, for example, I was doing the stage manager in our town in high school, and he would come in, and it was his favorite play. And he showed me, he said, no, when you're describing that, he said, you describe that big butternut tree. You've got to see that tree. And when you're working in the drugstore and you're getting ice cream out of the ice cream box, you've got to reach your hand way down in there and pull it. I mean, he was so animated. He came
specific.
Alive. Very specific and very much alive. So all of his BS about not do this, you're not going to do this, you're going to be a lawyer.
But did he live long enough to see you succeed?
Yes,
And what did he?
Well, that was the good part.
Then you're a genius.
Yeah, well, then it was a good thing. Yeah, because it wasn't until I got to Berkeley and I was given an edict. You're not going to be in any plays. First year, as a freshman, I was studying political science and economics. I mean, that was it. I was gonna
do the same thing.
So at the end of the first year, I got a play. I finally passed. I got through the first year, and he said, "Okay, if you want to do a play, you can do a play." So I did a play, and that was it. It was a play called To Learn to Love. It was written by one of the professors, and it was about these Navy guys, and it was a big hit on campus. Professor cast me the next semester as De Flores in The Changeling, a Jacobean play written by Thomas Middleton. Middleton and Rowley, great, great piece. Sort of a Richard III type of character, and I had, success with that. And my parents came and saw me, and they said, "Well, I guess, you may have some talent, so maybe if this is what you want to do, we'll support you." So they came around.
Knowing you had some talent, at least they thought you're on to something.
Yeah, and I loved it. I mean, I couldn't stand economics and political science, man. I was terrible.
This was at USC?
No, Berkeley.
At Berkeley.
So. Yeah, I went 4 years.
And you got a degree in drama?
I got a degree in drama and English, yeah.
And
yeah.
Then what did you do after that?
Then I went to Yale Drama School for a year.
What was the program there? Was it longer than a year, or you finished the whole
thing
in a year?
No, it was a 3-year program. I only stayed a year. I didn't like it at all.
Why?
Well, in those days, Constance Welsh was the acting teacher, and she was pretty much very much old school, learning all these phonetic signs and symbols. And I mean, this had nothing to do with what I was interested in. I had done 2 summers at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival between my junior and senior year and between my senior year and my first year at Yale. And played some pretty good part, Henry V and Mercutio and Baron. I was getting my feet wet with Shakespeare and these big, wonderful
was
parts.
Was Shakespeare a part of your childhood and your upbringing?
No.
I mean, why are you so, you're pretty much steeped in Shakespeare in your early stage career. Why? This was just your own passion.
Oregon Shakespeare Festival.
That's what was responsible for it.
Yeah.
That's you went there and you were at home.
That's right. That's where it started. And then when I came back east, I was at Yale, and I wasn't crazy about Yale.
No more phonetic symbols.
Right, no more phonetic, And Joe. And
after that year, Joe found you.
Joe Papp, yeah. And
thanks to Oregon Shakespeare Festival, you were ready.
Yeah, I think so.
Pretty much.
And Henry Hughes, Saturday, he was a drama critic for the Saturday Review, wrote a nice review of me doing Henry V. Joe had read that, and when I got to Yale, I called the New York Shakespeare Festival and wanted to audition. He said, "Come on down." So I went and I met Joe Papp in this smoke-filled office here in Manhattan. I sat down and he said, "Okay, what are you going to do for me?" And I said, "Well, I'll do a little piece from Henry V, Upon the King." And I started reading. Upon the King, Let Us Our Lives. That's it. Are you a member of Equity? I said, "No." He said, "Well, you're going to be. You're going to play Marcellus in my production of Hamlet this summer. Julie Harris is going to be playing Ophelia. Alfred Ryder is going to be playing Hamlet. We'll see you this summer." That was it. I walked out there. I was floating on air.
Sure.
I mean, that was it, And then summer of 1964. And then I went to England after that on a Fulbright scholarship to the London Academy of Music and Dramatic Art.
For what?
To study for a year.
Well, why did you stop? Now you've got, I wonder if this is the beginning of a pattern where you get the hot hand here and Joe Papp wants you.
Yeah.
And then you say, "Okay, hold on, fellas, I got to go over to London for a year."
Well, that's it. And he was not happy about that, Joe. And interestingly enough, he was also on, I didn't realize this, it was just a coincidence, he was on the screening committee for the Fulbright guys. And when I came in, he said, "What are you here for?" And I said, "I'm auditioning for," and he said, "Don't do Upon the King again. I've seen it. Do something else." And
He was tough.
And I did not, I was not given Fulbright. I was chosen as an alternate. I was really depressed. That summer, I got a note from the Fulbright Commission saying, "The guy who was supposed to go dropped out, so you're in."
Made it by the skin of your teeth.
That's it. Yeah.
Now, why Lambda? Were you going to train for the musical theater?
For classical theater.
Right, for classical theater.
Yeah.
And you were there for a year?
I was there for a year.
What did you benefit from that?
Well, first of all, the exposure to the English theater in that year was unbelievable.
It's incomparable.
Unbelievable. And I saw Olivier do not only Othello, I saw him do The Master Builder, saw his production that he directed of the Crucible. It was an amazing year.
Were you ever tempted to stay there?
No.
Did you feel you belonged there?
No. Americans doing classical theater still is looked on a little bit askance by the English. I mean,
sure.
Just like we don't,
I don't want them to touch Williams either.
Exactly.
Right.
It's the same deal.
So you finished there and you came right home.
I came back. Then I came to Lincoln Center, and I auditioned for Jules Irving and Herbert Blau, who were just coming from the Actors Workshop in San Francisco. And they said, come on in. You're in the company. So I was married at the time.
Why'd you do that?
I know. Well, that was a mistake. That was a mistake. And then,
what's the longest run you've ever done as an actor on stage?
About 9 months. About
that was it.
Well, no, Other Desert Cities ran for about almost a year, I think. That's about it for me.
What's the role you've been the most connected to?
Well, I did Hamlet 3 times mm-hmm. to try to get it right. I never did. I never got
that. Why do you say that?
3 different productions.
What was the first one?
Long Wharf Theater. Arvin Brown directed it.
What year?
Let me see if I can remember the year. It had to be 70. I think it was 70. I was they say Hamlet's 30, mm-hmm. So I was about 30 when I did it, yeah. Mm-hmm. And
so you were up in New Haven.
I was up in New Haven, and the first time you play that part, I was so intimidated by the fact of all the other actors who had played it, and it's intimidating. I mean, mm-hmm.
This is your Hamlet.
That's right.
It becomes your Hamlet.
And most of the time I was concerned about getting the lines right and getting, just getting the moves right, just putting it all together and then trying to figure it out. That summer, Joe Papert came and saw it and he said, come into the park and we'll do it, a different production. And I got closer to it. I felt I never had the perfect show, but I got closer to it. And then
Right after New Haven.
Right after.
And then what?
2 years later, Mark Taper Forum in Los Angeles. Totally different production, Gordon Davidson directing. And I had one night where I got close, where I really got close. And then I don't know what happened. I think it was in the very last scene. I think the hardest thing about Hamlet is after that amazing duel in the last act, when he dies, is not to be caught breathing on stage. One of the hardest things to do, I think, in that particular play. I mean, anyway.
Talk about Houston. What was it like?
Oh, God. Well, I remember the first time I met him. He came to visit me on the set of Doc. We were shooting a Western in Spain with Faye Dunaway and Hercule, and then we were in this script, Fat City, written. It was a very popular book written by Leonard Gardner about boxing, and he came to see me personally on the set. I mean, to have John Huston visit me on the set of a movie, I mean, it was, and he was very gracious, and he said, "Stace, I've got a part for you, and I think you ought to take a look at this." And he treated me as if I was his son, right from the word go. I mean, he was so warm.
He welcomed you.
Yeah.
That's rare in the business.
Oh, yeah, but he was larger than life. He didn't make any apologies for that. I mean, and he loved to gamble. And
I wonder what that was about.
Well, it's very interesting because I love to gamble too.
What's your game?
Well, with him it was backgammon.
Right.
We would play backgammon between scenes on
for
the
100
set.
Bucks a game?
No, dollar a point.
Yeah. Oh, he just liked it for the fun.
Yeah, but
he wasn't a gambler trying to make money.
Not with me. Now, I remember we went to. We were in London together, and he would, he said, "Let's go to the casino." He loved, he'd go
do a little gaming.
He had a little gaming. Very good.
Yes.
I don't know. What is it about gambling? It's the Dostoevsky thing. I mean, the challenge of, they say that people gamble to lose. They don't really gamble to win. How to compensate for the feeling of loss. I think there's something to that. I mean, that was, Anyway.
I love the line someone told me that people gamble to find out if God favors them or not.
Ooh.
They want to know, does God favor me today?
Well,
If I win, then that's my sign that God favored me.
I like that. I get on my iPhone and there's a game called Bejeweled. It's a little bit like Angry Birds.
Right.
And I feel like if I can get it right, then God's looking good.
Yes,
I think
I'm complete.
Something. Yeah. I love it. I mean,
What was it like shooting the movie with Houston? What was he like as a director? Was he insightful for you? Did he help you?
Absolutely.
He was.
Oh, yeah. Well, he's an actor, first
of course.
And he always wanted to give you your space. He said there's only two directions, Days, a little more or a little less.
Hmm.
That was it. He would let us block the scenes. He would go, Susan Terrell and I, God love her, he would say, go in there and you stage the scene the way you feel like it should be staged in a domestic scene in a kitchen or something like that. And we would go in there and we would stage the scene. We'd work out the moves.
There's a lot of trust to have in his actors.
Tremendous. Yeah. He'd come in and look at it, and then he'd move things around a little bit, make a tweak here, tweak there. And that's the way he worked. The thing that really fascinated me about Houston was at the very end of the movie, I'll never forget, Jeff Bridges and I were sitting in this cafe, and it's the very last scene of the movie. And in the background, there were these people sitting at tables, smoke rising, and they were gambling, and they were playing cards, and they were talking to each other. And he said, all right, I want everybody in the background to just freeze. And you could see the smoke rising up, so you knew it was not a freeze frame that was done technically by the editors. It was something that he directed. And I said, John, why did you do that? And he said, when Billy Tully looks over there and sees nothing, he said, I just want there to be the feeling that God is intervening here in some way. I said, well, why? How did you come up with this idea? And he said, the devil made me do it.
Wherever John Houston is, I want him to know that when the time comes for me and Stacy, we'll be more than ready to join him for backgammon and cigars. I'm Alec Baldwin, and here's the thing. Take a listen to our archive, more in-depth conversations with artists, policymakers, and athletes like Dwight Gooden.
My mom was very strict, you know, very direct with stuff, where my dad kind of gave me a pass with a lot of things as long as I was playing baseball.
Hear from Dwight Gooden and NFL quarterback Andrew Luck at heresthething.org. Here's the Thing is produced by Emily Botine and Kathy Russo, with Chris Bannon, Jim Briggs, Ed Herbstman, Melanie Hoops, Monica Hopkins, Trey Kay, Sharon Mashihi, Lou Olkowski, and Josh Rogozin. Thanks to Larry Josephson and the Radio Foundation. Here's the Thing is produced by WNYC Radio and distributed by PRX.org, the Public Radio Exchange.